Today is Wednesday, May 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, Special Counsel Robert Mueller made his first public statement on the Russia investigation Wednesday.
I'm speaking out today because our investigation is complete.
Severe weather continues to wreak havoc across the United States, and water restrictions are to be imposed in Australia's biggest city for the very first time. Those stories and more are ahead on today's International Edition. In Washington today, Special Counsel Robert Mueller made his first public statement on the investigation of Russian interference in the United States 2016 election. The statement comes amid demands for Mueller to testify on Capitol Hill about his findings and tension with Attorney General William Barr over his handling of the report.
Now, I have not spoken publicly during our investigation. I'm speaking out today because our investigation is complete. The Attorney General has made the report on our investigation largely public. We are formally closing the Special Counsel's office, and as well, I'm resigning from the Department of Justice to return to private life.
Mueller said his appointment as special counsel was charged with looking into interference in the 2016 presidential election. He said, as alleged by a grand jury indictment, Russian intelligence officers who were part of the Russian military launched a concerted attack on the U.S. political system. The indictment alleges that they used sophisticated cyber techniques to hack into computers and networks used by the Clinton campaign and stole private information, and they released that information through fake online identities and through the organization WikiLeaks. He said the releases were designed and timed to interfere with the U.S. election and to damage a presidential candidate. What many have focused on, however, is the report's second volume.
The order appointing me special counsel authorized us to investigate actions that could obstruct the investigation. We conducted that investigation, and we kept the Office of the Acting Attorney General apprised of the progress of our work. And as set forth in the report, after that investigation, if we had had confidence that the President clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so. We did not, however, make a determination as to whether the President did commit a crime. The introduction to the Volume 2 of our report explains that decision. It explains that under long-standing department policy, a president cannot be charged with a federal crime while he is in office.
And Mueller added this clarification of that long-standing guideline about not charging a sitting president.
The Constitution requires a process other than the criminal justice system to formally accuse a sitting president of wrongdoing. And beyond department policy, we were guided by principles of fairness. It would be unfair to potentially accuse somebody of a crime when there can be no court resolution of the actual charge.
Now, Mueller said that if he were to testify before Congress about his work as special counsel, he would limit his testimony to the research within the report.
It contains our findings and analysis and the reasons for the decisions we made. We chose those words carefully, and the work speaks for itself.
White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders released a statement shortly after Mueller completed his remarks. It read in part, quote, "The special counsel has completed the investigation, closed his office, and has closed the case. Mr. Mueller explicitly said that he has nothing to add beyond the report and therefore does not plan to testify before Congress." It continued, "After 2 years, the special counsel is moving on with his life, and everyone else should do the same." End quote. Tornadoes damaged homes and knocked down trees and power lines Tuesday night in the U.S. state of Kansas in the latest round of severe weather that has repeatedly battered the central part of the country since last week. The tornado activity just west of Kansas City injured at least 12 people, while severe storms sparked warnings as far east as New York. National Weather Service forecaster Jared Geyer says multiple supercell thunderstorms and tornadoes struck around Kansas City and points to the west yesterday.
We'd even seen at least media reports that Kansas City International Airport had to be shut down for a while related to tornado debris. And that area around Kansas City was particularly hard hit by tornadoes, and survey crews will be out today to take a closer look at that damage and assess ratings.
Residents of the Midwestern states of Ohio and Indiana spent Tuesday sifting through the ravages of a series of powerful tornadoes that killed at least one person, injured more than 130 others, and destroyed homes, schools, and businesses. The National Weather Service said as many as 55 tornadoes may have touched down late Monday into Tuesday across eight states. Tuesday was the 12th consecutive day where multiple tornadoes were reported in the United States. While the high number of twisters is not unusual, they are not usually as widespread. National Weather Service meteorologist David Roth says the severe weather in the plains continues to move east.
Those showers and thunderstorms are already streaming east-northeastward, and it looked like the major problems for heavy rain, flash flooding, would be this afternoon for northeast Texas, southeast Oklahoma, and western Arkansas.
As the stormy weather plagued the central U.S., several cities in the south experienced a record-shattering high temperature, while one ski resort in the western state of California plans to stay open until August. National Security Advisor John Bolton says there was a failed attack recently on the Saudi oil port city of Yanbu. AP's Charles de Ledesma reports.
Bolton's remarks made in the Emirati capital of Abu Dhabi mark the first time anyone has alleged that Yanbu was targeted during the ongoing Persian Gulf crisis. Yanbu is the terminus, the final point, of Saudi Arabia's east-west oil pipeline. That pipeline was recently targeted by Yemen's Houthi rebels in a coordinated drone attack. Bolton said he suspected Iran was behind the failed attack, but did not elaborate. Officials in Saudi Arabia could not be immediately reached for comment. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Here are other major stories from around the globe. A judge has ruled Boris Johnson, the favorite to replace Theresa May as Britain's prime minister, must appear in court over allegations he lied about Brexit by saying Britain would be some $440 million better off outside the EU. Presidential advisor Jared Kushner is in Jordan as he tries to rally Arab support for a U.S. Middle East peace conference next month in Bahrain. Japanese police on Wednesday raided the home of a man suspected in a knife attack against schoolgirls and others this week that left two people dead before he killed himself. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and with our VOA mobile application. This is International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
A pair of scientists from Kansas suggest in a new study that a nearby star explosion may have played a role in forcing modern human ancestors to walk on 2 feet. The study suggests a supernova may have bombarded Earth 2.6 million years ago with so much cosmic radiation that it flooded the lower atmosphere with electrons. The researchers suggest this surge in atmospheric ionization set off a huge increase in cloud-to-ground lightning strikes that set off forest fires around the world. It's thought the fires forced human ancestors, who were accustomed to climbing and living in trees, out of the forests and onto grassy and open savannas. The researchers propose that our ancient relatives were then forced to walk across the grasslands, but to look out for predators, had to learn to walk upright on 2 feet. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. In recent weeks, Australia and India have re-elected incumbent prime ministers. Analysts say these Asia-Pacific countries, who have a difficult relationship with China, are unlikely to make the kind of policy changes that Beijing has been seeking for a long time. To understand that, I spoke earlier with reporter Saibal Dasgupta in Beijing. Australia recently re-elected Prime Minister Scott Morrison, and India gave, well, a landslide victory to Prime Minister Narendra Modi's parties. So what possibly would China be looking for from these two leaders?
China would be looking for a change in the existing policy of Australia and India when it comes to some major issues. One of them is the trade war issue with the U.S. China would like India and Australia to express some kind of support to the idea that globalization and trade war are opposite and the U.S. should not go ahead with it. Second thing it wants is support in the Belt and Road program, which is constructing infrastructure across the globe. India has dropped it. Australia is not eager about it. The third is China's Huawei company, which is possibly the most advanced in 5G technology. It wants to replicate it across the world. Recently, the Trump administration has banned it. But Australia was the first country, long before the US, to block it. So China would very much like the Australian government to revise or revisit them. But experts tell me that Australia is not going to do that. India, on the other hand, has opened up 5G trials for Huawei. The question is whether US will exert a lot of pressure on India to force India to reject Huawei.
You mentioned that Australia may be unlikely to support some of China's initiatives. Can you explain why?
There is a series of reasons. First of all, in the case of Huawei, there is a worldwide, at least in Western society, fear that those technologies of 5G communication technologies that they are could be used for the purpose of spying. The second reason is Australia is unhappy with China's military bases in South China Sea. It doesn't want itself in a position where China can block the shipments, the ships from Australia. The third reason why Australia is worried about China is that China has expanded its footprint and influence over ASEAN. Australia has traditionally been very close to Indonesia and Malaysia. We look at the map, physically Australia is very close to the Indonesian island and small boats pass away. So Australia is a big, big trader with this country. China is already replacing Australia on a lot of products and is feeling the pinch.
What about the prospects for relations between India and China?
That's a very interesting issue. India has been extremely suspicious and distrustful of China because of a variety of reasons. One of the reasons is, of course, the border issue between the two countries. It's more than 70 years old that the two countries are fighting over the border. The second is the Dalai Lama. In 1959, Dalai Lama left China and settled in India. And China considers Dalai Lama as a thorn on the side of China, and China regards him as a separatist. Third point of difference is, of course, China's extensive support to Pakistan, to the point where it is hurting the sovereignty of India, because China is building construction roads, bridges, a lot of infrastructure in an area which is a disputed area, which is claimed both by India and Pakistan.
And that was reporter Saibal Dasgupta in Beijing. Chinese tech giant Huawei filed a motion in a U.S. court Wednesday challenging the constitutionality of a law that limits its sales of telecom equipment. VOA's Jeff Custer has that report.
The motion is the latest action in Huawei's ongoing clash with the U.S. government.
Just now, we filed a motion for summary judgment. By doing this, we hope that the court can issue a judgment in the fastest and most efficient way, declare restrictions on Huawei as unconstitutional, and stop enforcement of related sections.
During a press briefing Tuesday in Beijing, Huawei's chief legal officer, Songlu Peng, said his company had filed a motion for summary judgment asking the court to rule on whether it's constitutional for the U.S. to implement a military spending provision that bars the government and its contractors from using Huawei equipment. And Song didn't mince words.
Politicians in the U.S. are using the strength of an entire nation to come after a private company. They are using every tool they have, including legislative, administrative, and diplomatic channels. They want to put us out of business.
2 weeks ago, the U.S. Commerce Department placed Huawei on its entity list, effectively barring U.S. firms from selling its technology without government approval. Huawei relies heavily on U.S. components, including computer chips, and about one-third of its suppliers are American. The move has already affected the company's U.S. partnerships. Song also denied Washington's claim that Huawei threatens international cybersecurity. Jeff Custer, VOA News.
And you're listening to VOA's International Edition.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
And this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Police in Senegal will receive EU development aid in the coming weeks that will be used to help crack down on migrant smuggling. The new program called COP, for Common Operation Partnerships, aims to get police in Europe on active service in Africa. While such EU-funded development projects on security are nothing new, this latest effort in Senegal is a novelty. EU policymakers see this project as a stepping stone toward establishing what they call joint investigation teams. My colleague Kim Lewis spoke with reporter Catherine Field about this initiative.
What the EU is trying to do is, on the one hand, help Senegal to get on top of the issues related with illegal immigration, the sea crossings, people who set out from Senegal to try and reach parts of Europe, and particularly they're looking at people traffickers who are operating in that area. The other thing that the EU is trying to do is to ease the unrest within the European Union, countries within the European Union who are concerned that this issue of unregulated, irregular migration isn't being taken seriously by these particular countries. And in particular, they are looking at Senegal to say that they don't feel that the government is doing enough. So putting in place on the ground European police, European investigators on the ground in West Africa will go some way, they hope, into curbing this illegal, irregular migration.
Also, another big concern is the returnees. And can you tell us really what is going on with that and why is it hard for them to return back to Senegal?
This is a serious problem, not just for the European Union, but for the IOM. They say that the Senegalese government doesn't really meet its commitments when it comes to accepting returnees. On the one hand, yes, when you look at the huge number of migrants that came into Europe 2015 and 2016. You look at the numbers from Senegal, and they aren't that high. They're around 10,300. But when you look at the number of returnees, it's very low. It's less than 10% are actually accepted back by the authorities there. Now, the European Union says that is partly because it's considered very negative for these people to return. It shows that there was, in fact, a failure for these people to have been able to find a job in Europe and to send back remittances. What you have to remember is quite often the people who have left and come to Europe, they've paid people traffickers somewhere along the line, and quite often families have put up this money. And the idea was that this money was put up so as that person could get to Europe and refund the money. On top of that, when you look at the amount of remittances that are submitted from expatriate Senegalese back to Senegal, that's very high. It's something like 13% of Senegalese GDP comes from expatriates sending money back. So this is a problem, and the European Union realizes that at the moment it will not be able to solve this issue from one day to the next. What it can solve, though, or help to solve, is that people just don't set out for Europe on this belief that once they get to Europe, they will get a job and they will be able to make money.
Also, what is the Austrian connection with this?
This whole idea of having police and investigators on the ground comes from Austria. It was an idea set up back in 2016 by the Austrians when they had the presidency of the EU. So they came up with this scheme. They set it up. It is based in Vienna. They are also setting up a second one of these bases in September of this year. That's going to be set up in Italy, in Sicily, as another way of trying to have an actual network of these types of operations that will stop the flow of migrants, that will deal with the people traffickers, that will deal with the piracy involved in this. Now, they say that it is actually the Austrians that started this. They got a lot of support from the EU from it, and that's why it's being called the Austrian Connection.
And that was reporter Catherine Fields in Paris speaking with my colleague, Kim Lewis. Water restrictions are due to be imposed in Sydney, Australia, the biggest city there, for the very first time in almost a decade because of falling reservoir levels and a long-standing drought. Residents who breach the regulations could be fined $150. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The flow of rainwater into some of Sydney's reservoirs is at its lowest since the Second World War. From Saturday, households will face restrictions that will target the use of water outdoors. Garden sprinklers will be banned, and tougher measures could follow. The New South Wales state government says that early and decisive action will help to conserve supplies as a record-breaking drought worsens. Australia's Bureau of Meteorology is predicting below-average rainfall and higher temperatures for the next 3 months across much of the continent. The New South Wales State Minister for Water is Melinda Pavey.
With the lowest inflows into Sydney's water storages since 1940, the government's come to a decision that it is best to go into water restrictions. We may get rain. The Bureau of Meteorology's predictions aren't fabulous, but as we know, as we plan weekends, they're not always right, and I hope that they are wrong. We are taking the appropriate course of action to take it to level one.
New South Wales has been in drought since the middle of 2017. Catherine Port from Sydney Water, a government-owned company, says its officers will patrol to ensure the water ban isn't broken.
Sydney Water have a team of community water officers that will be out in the community to monitor and ensure that water restrictions are complied with. Penalties that will apply is $220 for individuals and $550 for businesses.
Critics, though, insist that Sydney's plight is in part the result of poor planning and a failure to take water recycling seriously. Falling reservoir levels prompted authorities to switch on a multi-million dollar desalination plant in January. At full capacity, it could supply Sydney, a city of 4.6 million people, with 15% of its water needs. Smaller towns in New South Wales, Australia's most populous state, are also facing water crises. In Tamworth, residents are on level 4 restrictions that ban all use of water outdoors, and swimming pools can't be filled or topped up. Level 5 restrictions are considered to be an emergency measure. Australia is the world's driest inhabited continent. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And in Nepal, the nation commemorated the first anniversary of the ascent of Mount Everest Wednesday amid a climbing season marred by the highest death toll in 4 years and a debate on whether the government should limit permits to prevent dangerous overcrowding on the world's highest peak. Government officials said that an event in Kathmandu celebrating the successful climb of Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay in 1953 would be conducted and that there were no plans to cap permits. Nepal is one of the world's poorest countries and takes in $300 million each year from climbing. A record number of 381 permits were issued this year. 11 people have died on Everest, including 9 in Nepal, likely due to altitude sickness, which is caused by low amounts of oxygen at high elevations and can lead to headaches, vomiting, shortness of breath, and mental confusion. And that is going to do it for us today. On behalf of our director, Patrice Martin, and engineer, Rob McLean, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, video stories, and more, be sure to follow VOA on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And don't forget, with our VOA mobile app, you can download your stories and take them with you. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a wonderful Wednesday.